This episode is brought to you by Fast Enterprises. Fast helps motor vehicle agencies serve the public by delivering enterprise modernization projects on time and on budget every time. Improve customer service and be ready for whatever the future brings. Give Fast a call at 1-877-ASK-FAST or visit us on the web at fastenterprises.com. Welcome to AnvaCast, bringing news, information, and expertise to the Anva community. Here's your host, Ian Grossman. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the AnvaCast. This week, I am excited to welcome the national spokesperson for one of Anva's key partner organizations that we've worked with a lot over the years, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, MAD. And I'm excited to welcome to her first appearance on the AnvaCast, MAD's fairly new national president, Alex Oddy. Alex, welcome to the AnvaCast and to the Anva community.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alex, MAD, I think is fair to say, is a household name. Certainly, I can tell you that our listeners that are listening, being in the field of highway safety, driver safety, are familiar generally with the idea of MAD and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. But I don't know if everyone already really appreciates what the organization is about, and particularly understanding your role as what MAD refers to as national president, which doesn't necessarily mean you are the executive managing the staff and running the operations of MAD. So let's start there. Tell us, what does it mean that you are the national president of MAD?
So as the national president, I'm really the key spokesperson for the organization. I am not, we have a wonderful CEO, and that is not my role, but I am the spokesperson for the organization and really the face of victims of drunk driving.
And so is that a full-time commitment for you, or is that a volunteer activity you do in addition to, you know, quote unquote, a day job?
This is a full-time commitment, a full-time job for sure. More than full-time, as I've quickly learned.
Yeah.
But I'm super excited to be a part of it. It's a 2-year term. So my term began January 1st.
So brand new. You're only about a month and a half into it.
Yes.
Has the approach to having to do the job, I imagine it's changed with the restrictions of no in-person gatherings, limited travel. I imagine previously folks in your role would be out and about at events and doing spokesperson type things. But now that really is turned on its head.
Absolutely. So typically when I interviewed for the job, we thought COVID might have gone away, as everyone did. We didn't realize it was going to last so long. And so I was told that it would be 75% travel. You travel all the time. And the past presidents have talked to me about that. You know, you're never home. You're gone all the time. And really, it's completely different. I went to Dallas for my onboarding for my first week to, see my office and to meet everyone. And then came back home to Kentucky, and everything has been completely remote since. I had a couple trips get canceled because of COVID kind of stuff. And I have, testified in state legislation, spoken at events, and done all of that virtually. So it's nice to have a bit of a slow start in that way, but I'm ready to get out there.
Yeah, well, certainly, hopefully, starting a 2-year term, I think we all can hope that you're going to get the best of both worlds. Otherwise, it means this is going to go on even longer than anyone bargained for sure. So for those that know MAD by name and know MAD by the overall mission of, trying to end impaired driving, drunk driving. Give me the deeper dive into what does MAD do as an organization that maybe people don't really realize on a day-to-day basis?
So like you said, those that know MAD know that our mission really is to end drunken drug driving and to serve the victims that have been impacted by these crimes. On a day-to-day basis, a lot of what we do is work on legislation. There is, of course, offices across the country that house our victim service specialist, and they work day to day with victims, supporting them emotionally and through what they're going through in different situations and also through their court cases. So MAD is super involved day to day with victims, but also we work on legislation, state and federal, that will help us in drunk driving.
So let's talk a little bit about the state and federal legislation, because obviously the majority of our community is focused on that government role in doing what we can to save lives. So what are the current priorities for MAD when it comes to state and federal legislation?
So in state legislation, of course, we want to get all fender ignition interlocks passed, and that has been a big priority for MAD over the last several years. And also we, you know, different states come to us when they have stuff on the books. For example, Maryland right now has a law that would make boating under the influence count, voting under the influence offenses count as repeat DUI offenses. Tennessee has a similar law that would make voting under the influence have the same penalty as driving under the influence. Some states have laws going on right now regarding ignition interlock. But federally, our top legislative priority right now is to make impaired driving prevention technology standard on every vehicle. Hmm. If the driver's impaired, whether by drugs or alcohol, the car won't start. Mm-hmm. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety has told us that this will save more than 9,000 lives a year. And while we know that more than 10,000 people are dying every year, we know that this won't completely end drunk driving, but this would be an incredible step. And a big thing that, you know, affects your community with this law is we know that licensing agencies throughout the country truly are on the front lines when it comes to dealing with those who have a DUI arrest or conviction.
Right.
Licensing, everything like that. And our advocacy efforts in Congress will lead to a day when there are no more people arrested or convicted drunk drivers or impaired drivers interacting with the DMV, because ultimately our hope is that there will be no more impaired driving.
Of course. But in the meantime, while we go through that transition, does MAD have any viewpoints on the licensing part of sanctions for drunk driving? And is there another role that MAD is looking for the DMVs to play in terms of the life cycle of holding drunk drivers accountable?
It's so important for me and for us here at MAD that drunk driving should be treated as the violent, preventable crime that it is every single time. Mm. And so we think across the board, you know, regardless if the drunk driver hurts or kills someone, they are still making a potentially deadly choice. And we know that the average drunk driver has driven drunk 80 times before they get caught the first time. So for us to be able to treat that as a severe violent crime every single time, you know, we need to nip that in the bud before it continues, before they are able to hurt or kill someone.
Sure. So it was interesting that the first thing you talked about with the legislation priorities related to changes in laws of impaired boating. And I know, reading some background on you, that that holds a special connection for you. Tell us your story as to, you know, what led you to be involved with the MAD community and has given you the connection to fight for these victims.
Absolutely. So, of course, impaired boating is super close to my heart. And so we're working on lots of different federal legislation, but those were just, you know, forefront of mind, of course. I was 13 years old, so a little over 10 years ago. I am the youngest national president of MAD, if that wasn't obvious already. I'm 24, and I was 13 years old, and I was sitting on a jet ski behind my dad's house on Lake Harrington in Danville, Kentucky. I'd been on the water for years, had my boating license for years. It was, you know, no different than any other summer day. It was July 2nd of 2010. My family was putting our boat in the water so we could make sure it ran so that we could go visit some friends at a different lake for July 4th. Mm. And I was following my mom and my brother on my jet ski to make sure they made it back to our house okay. I was about 40 yards from my mom and my brother. They were docking our boat and I was waiting for them to finish so that I could dock the jet ski and we could go up to the house. There was a 17-foot bass boat coming under a nearby blue bridge, and I gave my mom a thumbs up to let her know I saw him coming and I wasn't going to move. When you get your boating license, they teach you that if a boat's coming towards you, don't move and try and anticipate where they're going to go. Just stay where you are and they'll go around you. Harrington's a super narrow lake with rock embankments on either side, so I was really close to the side. There was nowhere for me to go. I just sat there and waited for him to pass. He was headed towards my mom and my brother, and my mom screamed. He banked it to the left and never straightened up. He hit me going a little over 60 miles an hour. hit me from, which is unheard of on a lake, but especially a lake this narrow, hit me from the side, threw me off the jet ski. I landed face down in the water and was face down for 3.5 minutes. The boat went up over the jet ski and landed on top of my body.
Oh my gosh.
I sustained a really severe brain injury where my brain shook inside my head and started bleeding in 4 places and they couldn't make it stop. It's classified as shaken baby syndrome, but they didn't know what effect that would be on a 13-year-old. I shattered my jaw, so I now have 3 plates and 12 screws in my face that you can feel all the way down my face. I broke my neck, broke my collarbone, lacerated my liver, shattered both of my femurs because when I was thrown off the jet ski, I was holding on so tight with my legs, presumably because I was scared. I don't remember. But that when I was thrown off, I took the handlebars with me. And if you've been around a jet ski, you know it's all one piece and that's not supposed to be possible. They were unable to put my femurs back together, so I now have metal rods in place of bone in both of my thighs. And then when the boat came down on top of me, the propeller landed on my legs. My left leg was under the water just enough that it only required stitches. My right leg was severed by the propeller. The boat sunk. The man laughed and said, "Is everybody okay?" He was 3 times over legal limit 2.5 hours later. He was charged $250 and left to do it again.
I'm speechless. That's, well, one, a miracle that you're alive.
Absolutely.
I want to come back to this. He left to do it again, because I think that's important for our community, but really want to take a moment to appreciate your own survival story, which I know is what's so important to men in terms of helping survivors. Tell us what happens next. How do you come back from that? That, you know, now, you know, 10 years later, 11 years later is not a long time. And yet here you are, an extremely polished, thoughtful, positively spoken individual. How does that happen?
I knew pretty quickly that I wanted to be the last little girl that this ever happened to. You can ask any doctor in the nation, because trust me, I've asked a ton of them. There is no medical reason that I survived at all. And I knew that I wanted to be the last little girl that it ever happened to. And I know 10, almost 11 years later that I wasn't. And I will continue to fight until there is a last little girl. And I truly wish it had been me. I wish that, you know, my story could have made it not happen to anyone else. But it wasn't.
Is that when you first found MAD, when you and your family were introduced to the organization?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't even know. I'm sure I had heard of MAD, but I don't even know if I knew what MAD was before the crash. But it's really, you know, something I talk about all the time is it's a club you never want to join, but once you're in it, you can't get out. And my first memory of MAD is really, you know, my parents were mostly involved. They handled the court case and all that kind of stuff. But I did go to his arraignment and I was in a wheelchair and a neck brace. And he looked right at me when he said, "I'm not guilty. She shouldn't have been on the water." And I remember rolling out of the courtroom and a lady named Cassie Ettinger, who was a victim service specialist at the time, bent down and said, "Honey, are you okay?" And that was really my first, that's my first memory of having an interaction with MAD.
Interesting. And so then you started to get involved from then on?
Yes. So soon after that, you know, like I said, I wanted it to end. I wanted to be the last person ever. And so I started volunteering with MAD on a state level really soon after that, you know, and spoke at different high schools and stuff like that. And then in 2015, we had an all offender ignition interlock bill coming up in Kentucky. And I got involved with that. I was a senior in high school. My parents got a letter saying I was almost truant because I missed so much school, only because I was in Frankfurt. And that passed unanimously after many years of trying. And so I spoke out on behalf of that, spent a ton of time in Frankfurt talking and honestly crying in people's offices. And we made that happen. And then we were able to do that again in 2019. In 2015, it passed unanimously, but they had taken some teeth out of it. And so in 2019, we were able to go back and make it better, and it passed again. In 2014, I got involved with MAD National because I want to make it stop. I want to make it stop in Kentucky and everywhere else. And so I was named one of the national teen influencers in 2014. They selected 10 teenagers from across the nation to, you know, get together and learn more about MAD's programs and how to speak to students and that kind of stuff. And was there very thankful for that experience. And then in 2015, I was named the National Youth Activist of the Year in DC for my work on Ignition Interlock. And so very thankful for that experience, of course. I also got involved with Marcy's Law, which is a victims' rights organization.
Yeah.
In 2018, because truly, you know, Kentucky's a good old boy system. So how things went down wasn't the best in my situation, as is clear by the $250. So I got involved with that organization and we passed that in 2018, but due to some technicalities, it wasn't added to the Constitution at that time. And so we passed it again in 2020 and it was added to Kentucky's Constitution last November. And so that's one of the things I'm definitely most proud of.
Sure. And it shows you these things can change. We can fix these gaps in laws and regulations to never mind it happening again, stop it from happening in the first place.
Right.
So I know we're supposed to talk about legislation and programs, but back to your story, being the parent of one of my children is 13 years old. It strikes me that I have to ask you about your parents, as horrific and challenging a journey it must have been for you to be the parent watching a child go through this, how they were able to support you and be part of that journey.
So my parents have been divorced since I was a baby. They were rarely in the same place at the same time. And for some reason they were this day. I don't exactly remember why. I mean, they got along fine, but they were divorced. So it wasn't like they hung out. My mom and my brother were on the boat. My mom was a former trauma nurse. My brother was seven, and so they watched the whole thing. My dad was up at the garage, and because he had just driven our truck back from putting the boat in the water, and he didn't see but heard it.
Yeah.
And he was a former water rescue marine. Which, you know, crazy. Couldn't have had
a water rescue marine and a trauma nurse on scene.
And my brother and I, we each had a jet ski with our name on it. And I, the one with my name on it, the choke was broken. So I always took my brother's. He was seven. He couldn't drive it anyway. Why'd it matter? So I always took my brother's. And for some reason, and to this day, I don't know how he did it. But when my dad heard it, he thought to grab a pair of pliers out of the garage before he ran down to the dock so he could get on the other jet ski. And, you know, so I think the grief is different. I mean, they watched and they remembered and I didn't, but I'm the one that has to live with it. And so my family has always been incredibly supportive of anything I've wanted to do, but my parents said goodbye to me.
Yeah.
My parents were told I wouldn't survive the helicopter ride to the hospital. And then once I did, I was given 24 hours, 36, 48 for the first 4 days. I was in a coma on my own for 4 days and then medically induced for the remainder of a week. My parents didn't think that I was going to survive. And more so than that, I mean, they've dealt with the emotional part of I was never supposed to walk again. My mom never thought that I was going to be able to walk down the aisle in my wedding. And in 3 months from now, I will be doing that.
Oh, congratulations.
So, thank you. So, you know, it's been a journey for my family as well, but I think it's a different kind of grief, but they've supported me every step of the way.
Yeah. Well, I think that their story is also, I think, relevant because that's the core of MAD, right? It is mothers against drunk driving. And it's founded in that history of parents who lost children in the horrific crashes that is the power that made MAD what it is today.
And I think that's what's, you know, I'm a unique choice for MAD and they're also unique for me. But more than anything, I'm the youngest by, I think, 30 years, a lot. I'm the youngest by a lot. And I'm the first that's not a parent.
Yeah.
And I think my unique perspective in that is I'm the kid that was supposed to die. I wasn't supposed to be here, and I was the kid.
Yeah.
And so my perspective on that is different, and also my grief is very different. You know, I've lost many people close to me over the years, but I haven't lost someone to drunk driving. True. So my grief, I can't say that I've been exactly in those shoes, but I wake up every day and have to put a leg on. I live every day with the consequences of one man's bad choice. And so it's a different perspective, but I think it's a unique perspective, and I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. So, and what type of reaction have you gotten being the youngest, being the first, you know, non-parent? You know, you're not the parent that had to do the unthinkable of saying goodbye to a child, right? But you were that child. What type of reaction have you gotten from the community being such a different profile in the role?
The community's been amazing. I mean, all of our victims, all of our staff have been incredibly welcoming of me. And I think, like I said, it is a unique thing for MAD in that, you know, I am younger, so I know social media. And so I do a Facebook Live every Monday.
Oh, wow.
And I talk to hundreds of victims every Monday. And we all get to engage. And I felt very strongly when I came into this position that I want to be accessible. I want people to know that I care. I want people to be able to message me on Facebook at all hours of the night, and I'll respond. And so that's something I feel very strongly about. And our community has been so welcoming of me and of all of it.
That's great. That's fantastic. So take me back to a statement you made earlier about $250 fine and off to do it again. Was that a statement of this is the challenge with the policy, he's able to do it again? Or is this a case where he actually went out and reoffended?
So the man that ran me over, I was told by an officer who was, you know, involved in my crash, that he had three priors before he ran me over.
All both boating and either one. Okay.
Both. And that was his defense when we went, when in, you know, in the court case was, oh, I was about to get in my car and go home. So he really didn't see an issue. But I was also told, and while I haven't, you know, I do not feel comfortable doing the research on that. I feel very comfortable. I trust the person that told me this.
Mm-hmm.
I was 18 and I was doing a radio show for Kentucky Fish and Wildlife. And somebody said, how are you doing? And I said, you know, I just really hope you learned from it. And the man said, honey, he didn't. And I was told that day that he had had three more since me, which was a total of seven. And it's been 6 years since then. Mm. So I have no doubt that there have been more. I have no doubt that he will continue until someone stops him or until he hurts himself.
Yeah.
And that is so common. And it also adds to the trauma in that not only have I not stopped it for other people, the person that did it to me, the person that tried to kill me, has continued to do so.
He's still out there doing it. So I want to just shift gears a little bit before we start running out of time. MAD made a big decision a few years ago when they added on to not only ending drunk driving, but drugged driving for an organization that is always so connected to alcohol. Big statement to say this is about impairment, not just about alcohol and drug driving continue becoming a challenge. What does the world need to know about the battle against drugged driving that's different from what we know about alcohol impairment?
Very simply, it has not changed the way that we work, the way that we serve victims, or the way that we operate. But you know, alcohol is still the leading killer on our roadways, but drugs are on the rise. And impairment is impairment, regardless of whether it's drug or alcohol impairment. This legislative priority that we're working on federally would stop a driver from driving, whether they're impaired by drugs or alcohol. And it's very important to me and to MAD to serve victims affected by drug driving as well, But until this becomes a reality, we know now that the same tools and strategies that we have used and that we are using and that law enforcement use to stop drunk driving will also stop drug driving too, including sobriety checkpoints and saturation patrols and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. It really is just, it doesn't take away from our mission. It doesn't take away from our fight against alcohol impaired driving, but it adds to it.
Sure. So being of a younger generation, MAD has been very successful over the years in educating all those youth programs, many of which it sounds like you've spoken at. We all have those stories of going to those assemblies or the vehicle that's put on the lawn of the high school to shock you into understanding the dangers of drunk driving. And I think over the years, though it is still a huge challenge needs to be tackled, there's definitely been success in shifting the culture around drunk driving. It's not acceptable. You don't do one for the road. You know, if you're going somewhere, you make sure you have a plan. Conversely, there seems to be this anecdotal evidence, especially with the younger generation, that don't appreciate that certain drugs would have a similar effect on your behavior and that driving high is not as dangerous as driving drunk. Being part of that generation, I just want to ask you directly, are you seeing that? Is that anecdotal evidence that, you know, me being a Gen Xer and baby boomers want to say, oh, those kids today? Or is it a real challenge you're seeing with the younger generation?
No, I think it's a real challenge. I mean, I love the university I went to, but I went to UK. It's a state school. It's something that you see all the time. And I think this is like a rhymy buzz phrase, but driving high is still a DUI. Mm-hmm. It still is impairment. Your reaction time is slower. You can still hurt people. And there are still consequences to your actions. And so I think it's really just like exactly like you said, you know, 40 years ago, people would drive with a beer in their cup holder.
Mm-hmm.
But now we've had a culture shift. And I think the exact same thing needs to happen with drugs. And it'll take time. But that's where we need to get to.
Yeah, that's great. So, Alex, if you weren't doing this or what you're doing before your 2 years as president, you mentioned recently coming out of university. What is the parallel career track that might be waiting for you before and after this stint as national president?
So I graduated from UK in 2018. I went to UK thinking I was going to come out and be Aaron Andrews. I wanted to be on the sideline of a football field.
All right.
And I lived that dream and I got to do that. And I spent 6 years as a college football photographer and I loved it. And then once I graduated college, I started working for NASBLA, which is the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators. And I did research on boating under the influence, running parallel to driving under the influence. Mm-hmm. And I did that research for the Coast Guard and I was completely immersed in it. And, you know, so I think at this point, I don't think I'm ever going to leave the nonprofit safety world. I did that for 2 years with NASBLA and now I'm doing that here. And so I think this will MAD and, you know, ending drunk driving will always be a huge part of my life. But I think regardless, I'm probably never going to get out of the nonprofit advocating for safety.
Well, if that's the case, I want you to go ahead right now and write down amva.org. And in 2 years, I want you to call me back. We got to make sure that you stay connected with our community because I think
absolutely.
It's incredibly impressive what you have to offer. And I think we are all, you know, trying to move in that same direction of saving those lives and making our roads safer.
Well, thank you so very much for having me. I definitely will because in 2 years, so, you know, most national presidents, when they're done with their term, they're retired. When I'm done with my term, I will be 26.
Yeah,
so
you've got
I
a whole
definitely
year ahead
still
of
need
you.
A job.
Yeah. Yeah. Though that'll be an important part, you know, a pretty impressive piece of the resume, right? Well, yeah. You know, I'm a sitting president, so what, you know, I think the world is your oyster, Alex. And I look very much forward to watching the change and impact and improvements that not only MAD's going to keep doing, but you individually are going to do for our entire nation in making our roads safer. So thank you. Thank you very much for what you're doing. And thank you for joining us today, taking the time to chat with us. I'll even look forward to the idea that while you're still national president, we'll be able to have in-person conferences again and maybe get you to come speak at one of those conferences and share your thoughts with our members and our community.
I would love to. And the sooner we can get to in-person events and all meet in person, the better. So, absolutely. But thank you so very much for having me. And I would love to be involved in the future. So anything you need me for, you know how to get in contact.
Wonderful. Well, thanks to Alex. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to our producer, Claire Jeffrey. And we'll see you the next time on the AmvaCast. Stay well, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for AmvaCast, hosted by Ian Grossman, produced by Claire Jeffrey, music by Gibson Arthur. This episode was brought to you by Fast Enterprises. Visit us at amvacast.podbean.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify.